This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Kimchi, kombucha, sauerkraut, miso, and kefir, all fermented foods and drinks, have been around for centuries, but suddenly they're all the rage, aren't they? The simple reason is that they are packed full of gut-healthy bacteria, and we are finally waking up to just how much the trillions of microorganisms that live in our guts contribute to our mental and physical health. Gut health is now strongly linked to our overall well-being, including weight management, energy, and stress. The thing is, unless you're fermenting foods for yourself, these products are not cheap. Yet at just £1.50 for a 350-gram pot of Yo Valley Kefir, this daily boost, high in protein, low in fat, and with natural and fruity flavours to choose from, is in the yogurt aisle at all the major supermarkets. To find out more, head over to yovalley.co.uk. Hello, and thank you so much for tuning in to Food for Thought, a podcast on a mission to equip you with all the evidence-based advice you need to live and breathe a healthy lifestyle. I'm Rhianna Lambert, registered nutritionist, best-selling author of Renourish, A Simple Way to Eat Well, and founder of Retrition, London's leading private nutrition clinic. In each episode, I'll be joined by special guests, all of whom can be considered authoritative voices in health, so that together we can learn fact from fiction and empower the healthiest and happiest versions of ourselves with trusted expert advice. Pregnancy is one of the most incredible things the human body can do. Women's bodies undergo unbelievable changes, experiencing both amazing transformations and challenging symptoms. Every mother hopes for a healthy and happy pregnancy, but with so many elements involved throughout, knowing what the best practice is and routine to follow can be a serious challenge, particularly the first time around. So what exactly is the best approach to help ensure a safe pregnancy childbirth? And what impact can our actions have during those 9 months on our baby? Joining me today on the podcast to help uncover everything is Professor Lucilla Poston, Head of Women and Children's Health at King's College London. Hello, Lucilla.
Very good to be here. Thank you.
Excellent. I think the first question, obviously I'm 5 months pregnant at the moment, and as much as it's very exciting, there's also a lot of daunting things that can cross your mind. And can anyone ever really be prepared for childbirth for the first time?
I think probably not, because it's a huge change for everyone. But, you know, in terms of health, there are things that we can do. At your stage in pregnancy, my recommendation is really common sense. You know, listen to your body, do what your body's saying. Mm-hmm. Attend all your antenatal appointments, because that's really important. Don't skip on them. But, you know, general health, rest, good diet, not too many calories. You're not eating for two.
Yes. In fact, that's one of the biggest misconceptions, I think, isn't it?
It is. I think some people think it's a really good excuse for having a really high calorific diet and eating anything you want, and that's absolutely not the case. In fact, it's a time when you should think about improving your diet and improving your diet for life, because you're the person who's going to be feeding your baby. So thinking about what you're going to be feeding the baby as he's growing up or she's growing up, it's really important. Family diet, start thinking about it now.
There is a lot going on in my brain right now. And I think another area that we want to discuss on this podcast is how much does the mother's diet impact the baby? So when you are pregnant, does what you eat have a big impact on their, I don't know, neurology or their cognition? Certain areas.
Yes, it does. But we're very lucky in the United Kingdom that we actually, on the whole, eat a pretty good balanced diet, even though it may be a bit too much or some of the wrong micronutrients. But, you know, generally speaking, providing you have enough and a sensible amount of everything, it's not going to have a big effect on your baby's health. The one thing we really make an important mark about is folate in pregnancy, because it is important not only for the problems in terms of the baby's development of the spinal cord and so on, but also for the both growth of the baby, because babies with not enough folate may not grow so well. And then on top of that, the most important thing is actually the amount of calories that you eat. In terms of, if you have a low calorie diet, your baby may be too small, and small babies don't do so well. They may be at risk of infection. They may have problems, long-term problems in terms of lung function and so on. So that's very important. On the other hand, if you eat too much in terms of calories, then your baby may be too big, get much too big in some instances. And then you may have problems in delivery when the baby is just so big it can't be delivered normally. And then big babies tend to go on to be obese adults. So that's where obesity can start, right at the beginning of life, by being born too large. So both ends of the calorie spectrum, folate's very important. If you take the example of people living in low-income countries, that's where it really becomes very evident. So not enough calories, but not enough vitamin B12, not enough vitamin D perhaps. We are at risk of vitamin D deficiency in this country too.
Oh, I know. I mean, as recording this episode, I'm not sure when you're listening. Hopefully everyone's listening the day it comes out. But if you're re-listening back, at the moment in the winter months, we advise you do supplement.
Yeah, I think on top of folate, vitamin D, if you're not out in the sunshine, even in the winter, you just can't get enough vitamin D through the sun. So quite a lot of supplements. The supplements that you take with multivitamins may not be enough. So unofficial recommendations that you can take more without any damage. You need quite a lot of vitamin D on board, and that helps the baby's bones and helps baby's bone development and long-term bone health.
There are so many things. I think one really poignant thing that you said was it's either too little or too much. And I think finding that middle ground of what an actual healthy, balanced diet is for a mum to be, it can be quite tricky because there's so many confusing messages.
There are lots of confusing messages. If you look on the internet, actually, we've just done a study where we've looked at all the information on websites and apps in the United Kingdom. And so many of them have got information which is actually wrong. So, you know, you can't believe everything you read. But the general rule of thumb is eat well, eat a balanced diet, lots of fruit and vegetables, fibre, very important, enough vitamins that we're talking
omega
about.
Omega-3 is something I heard as well, which you should definitely get.
Well, omega-3 is important for fetal brain development, eyes. But we have enough in our diet on the whole. I mean, if you have an extreme diet without any fish, without any proteins and so on, you may run into deficiency problems, but most people will be getting enough. You know, you needn't suddenly start eating those omega-3 eggs or something. No. Most diets will have enough omega-3.
That's good to know. I think the concern with, because obviously it's from oily fish, or if you're a plant-based eater listening, because I know there's a rise in plant-based diets.
Yeah.
Perhaps they're not getting enough of those omega-3s. So are there any recommendations for plant-based eaters, vegan eaters?
Well, yes. I mean, omega-3 in terms of fish, oily fish is a good thing, but otherwise you can take supplements. It won't do you any harm.
Yeah.
But as I say, most people probably are quite sufficient.
That's so good to know. And we touched on obesity a little bit, so I'd love to delve into it, because we know that it is a growing problem for the future generations and something we should be addressing. Now, You've mentioned it could potentially be starting in the womb there. So would it be more because the mother perhaps is overweight, or is that the diet of the mother?
So if you, this is my area of research, and I've done a lot of this over the years. So if you look at the BMI of a mother, that is, you know, over 30 BMI is clinical obesity. But if you look at the BMI, the slippery slope going upwards, the BMI is related to the to obesity in the child as the child grows up. So is that something which is happening in utero, or is it the effect that's in the womb, or is it the effect of the mother eating too much and her family having the wrong sort of diet as she's nurturing the child as the child grows up? We can't really distinguish between the two, but we do know that the mother's BMI at the beginning of pregnancy is an important determinant of obesity in the child, but we don't know exactly what the mechanism is at the moment.
I mean, I think for so many women, when we're discussing the subject of weight and BMI, I remember when I was rushed on to the scales at my first midwife appointment, and for me that's okay, but it can be such a delicate subject.
It can be, and midwives and health professionals need to treat it very carefully, because some people can be very upset. Most ladies don't realise that having a high BMI or being obese can lead to problems in pregnancy, and it comes as a shock to some people. They feel perfectly well. Yeah. They haven't got any health problems. Maybe they think they're just a bit overweight and they don't really appreciate that they might be clinically obese, as we say, which is an awful word, isn't it, really?
It is. It's got such a stigma attached
to it. It has, yeah. Mm. But I do think we have to start being able to talk about obesity like we talk about smoking, because we don't point out the problems, then we can be held responsible for not telling people about it. And there are things that you can do. So I think it's responsible of the health professionals to raise the question, but to raise it in a delicate way without offence. And we spend a lot of our time thinking how we're going to talk to our ladies about it. But you know, the problems that women can face if they are overweight and obese, for example, diabetes in pregnancy, gestational diabetes,
yes,
it's on the up increase. It's soaring, and that's because our population is getting so overweight. So that means, you know, that you can have a baby who is getting very large in the womb. Then the problems are when it comes to birth that it's too big to go through the birth canal. So that leads to cesarean section. So about half of our women who are obese have to have a cesarean section. Mm. And it's not always what they want to do. So there's that problem. And diabetes is not an innocuous disease. So the ladies may end up being on insulin and having to have insulin injections. They may be able to control their diabetes by diet. So it's not a pleasant thing to have. And most people, really, when they're told they have gestational diabetes, are really shocked that they have a problem, because they feel absolutely fine.
Yeah.
But then they have to restrict their diet and maybe have drugs and so on. So it's not pleasant. And then, you know, delivery, there's more of a risk of hemorrhage if you are overweight and obese. And this is all risk. It's not that everybody is obese.
No, it's not all doom and gloom.
A lot of people, I mean, 70% probably of women who are obese have perfectly healthy pregnancies. But it's just a relative risk. And we have, as health professionals, like, need to get across to people what this risk is, and to have an appreciation of what risk is. But at the moment, about one in four or five women who are obese will get some form of gestational diabetes, even if it would be mild gestational diabetes. So yeah, it's, you know, people need to be aware, don't they?
Oh, completely. And I think it's definitely not something anybody would choose. So
no,
if they don't have the awareness, how would they know to even monitor that situation?
Yeah. But the important message from it is, if you are thinking about becoming pregnant and you are overweight or obese, then put off becoming pregnant for a while and try and do something about your weight, because it will help everything.
It's interesting you say that. So I did a extra course at university earlier this year on preconception nutrition. And we did discuss, it's such a delicate subject, but mm-hmm, you have to have it with your clients.
You do.
Yeah.
You do. And it's not just nutrition, it's lifestyle on the whole. So if you're thinking about becoming pregnant, I think most people who are really keen on their health and want to do well, they will think about folate, and that's incredibly important. But you know, how about how much alcohol you're drinking, which also puts on the calories,
and can it affect fertility, the amount of alcohol consumed?
Yeah, and the fertility, the obesity, smoking, of course. Some studies in the United Kingdom and the world have shown that if a mother smokes in pregnancy, you can pick that up in the DNA, the genes of the baby, when the baby is an adult. So whether that's having a long-term effect on health may well do, and we know it can do through small birth weight and so on, but the fact that you can pick up this mark on the baby's genes when that baby is going to adulthood is really shocking to most people, I think, and that, you know, it may be causing ill health. So the long-term effects are very important, not just the acute effects of having a healthy, bouncy baby, but the potential for affecting long-term health and also on the other side, that long-term disease. But what we want to do is to promote health, of course.
We do, and I think you mentioned, I mean, your career is expansive. You've got so many fascinating areas of research that you work with, and it's incredibly rewarding. But equally, you said you did a lot of research and you've looked into preconception a lot.
Yes.
And how important it is, perhaps. I think you said to think about it first.
Well, I think my experience, you know, I've done a big study in ladies who are overweight and obese, and we tried very hard to help them change their lifestyle and their diet and their physical activity, which we haven't mentioned yet.
Yes, we should.
Keep walking, ladies. Mm-hmm. Keep doing exercise.
Keep
strong. Don't stop. You know, you need to be fit, which can help your blood sugar too. So that's really good. Even if you have a bit of high blood sugar, glucose will go down if you exercise. So that's really good. But you really need to think about your health before pregnancy. It is so important. And if we do that, and everybody were to do that and to become fit for pregnancy, then a lot of the problems we see during pregnancy would disappear. And in my study that I was mentioning, the ladies did change their diet quite a bit, and they did improve their exercise quite a bit, but it wasn't enough. Mm. And so there was no reduction in diabetes in the ladies. We hoped we would, by suggesting a healthy lifestyle, reduce the risk of diabetes, and we didn't. And really, there are a lot of studies across the world which have shown the same thing. It's worth doing because you can improve your diet and you can prevent too much weight gain,
good
which is also
for
very
life.
Good habit for life. And in fact, we've just shown that 3 years later, the mothers are still have an improved diet. So that's great. So they're probably feeding their children a better diet, influencing the family environment. But, you know, what we have all thought across the world, I had a meeting this week about this, in fact, with people from Australia and Denmark and all over. And we think that, you know, we really do need to start helping people before they're pregnant. And then, you know, you've only got 9 months in pregnancy to improve your health, but you've got several years maybe before you become pregnant to really think about pregnancy. So you have a longer time to adjust your lifestyle as opposed to during pregnancy.
Very, very true and fascinating. I think it must be incredible to live a day in your life with the amount of new emerging research, the different voices you speak to. Have you seen the guidelines around pregnancy change over the years immensely?
About nutrition, no, not really. Mm. Certainly about weight management.
Yes.
So we are very keen to help prevent people putting on too much weight during pregnancy. Mm. And that is where the lifestyle advice comes in. But, you know, we are suggesting that it's really difficult to prevent these complications just by lifestyle interventions.
Well, it's opinions, isn't it? Because I'm a big advocate of exercise. I mean, it does change when you're pregnant how you feel.
Yeah, of course it does. You don't feel like it so much.
Especially in the first trimester. I mean, you just got to do what you can. Don't put pressure on yourself, I think. But I have received lots of, you know, positive and negative comments online for showcasing I'm keen to keep exercising. I think there's still that old wives' tale that you have to sit still.
Yeah, well, that is absolutely not right.
No. And how long, I mean, can you go up until your due date?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good.
Some of my colleagues in St. Thomas's Hospital did a study of the park runs, and they got questionnaire data from ladies who'd been involved in it and their pregnancy outcomes, and there's no evidence of any abnormality at all. And these were people who were running. I'm not suggesting everybody who goes it's pregnant should go out running immediately.
But
if you've been running, there's no reason why you shouldn't carry on running. And, you know, if you like walking, just keep walking, but don't stop. Obviously, contact sports you wouldn't want to do. You know, lady rugby players probably should stop. But otherwise, it's common sense, and I think the body tells you more or less what you should be doing or not. You feel it if you overdo it, don't you?
Yeah, and I think my aches and different, because I'm noticing expansion now around my middle, and you know, all these kind of different ligament pains and things. But I ache less when I'm on the move.
Yes, and it certainly helps you, your muscle strength, and to helps you support your baby. So all good reasons for keeping the exercise up.
And that leads me on nicely to the next question, which is about the current age that we're giving birth. I was reading a book. I've recently come back from my honeymoon, and she is a midwife that wrote a book, and she was saying that the number of people having babies in teens is now lower than women 35 plus. So I know we're all unique, and it's very difficult to put a number or an age limit on anything. But is there an age when our bodies are best suited to it?
I mean, as an academic, I would say you can't generalise because it's different for everybody.
Yeah.
But the quality of the eggs, the oocytes, which is very important when you want a healthy embryo, deteriorates with age. The average age that women are giving birth in the United Kingdom is just over 30 at the moment, which is quite high, and it's gone up over the years.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it is understandable why people delay childbirth, but then one does have to understand that there can be terrible disappointment about infertility, terrible disappointments that you think you'll still be fertile and you're not. And then there are all the complications that we know of in pregnancy, nearly all of them increase with age. So preeclampsia, which is another very horrible condition which occurs in pregnancy, but fortunately we usually pick it up early and we deal with it.
Could you explain to our listeners what preeclampsia is?
So preeclampsia is a complication in pregnancy which can be very serious, where women get very high blood pressure, and there's protein in the urine, which is what we test for. But it's a lot more than that. It can lead to fits, so that eclampsia means a fit, like an epileptic fit. And it can lead to blood clots, which can be fatal. So that is very unusual. We hardly ever lose ladies to preeclampsia in this country. You certainly do in Africa, where we also work. But we pick it up early because we pick up the blood pressure. And the main outcome of it in the UK is that we may have to deliver the baby early, so you may have a slightly premature baby. But it is dangerous. And I mean, the problem with all of, as I say, all of these disorders like preeclampsia, gestational diabetes, they all go up with age.
Yes. And I think obviously it's very difficult because you want to be positive and you want to say, but, you know, everyone has a good story of someone that got pregnant when they were 40 or they were 37 or these various ages. But realistically, it's the old saying, there's never the right time for anything in life, really, is there?
So. No, I mean, fertility certainly goes down quite dramatically after about 35. Certainly IVF ceases to work so well in older women, particularly over the age of 35. But for an individual, you can't say. It's impossible to say because of the wide biological variation. Mm. But if you take a population study, as it were, then oocyte quality goes down as the
age
goes
up. And it's fascinating if you look at the biology of the female body and the fact the age that we get periods, you know, the biological function versus how society's evolved and changed over time.
Exactly.
We're fighting a very difficult, especially for women. This is a little bit off topic, but we want to empower women with the opportunities that are there now, equal rights, exactly, careers, yet we are still fighting a biological clock that men just don't have.
No.
It's a bit unfair.
It does seem unfair, and it's extreme. I employ lots of women who are, you know, keen on a career. They're keen on having a family. And we all know that it's jolly difficult to juggle it all, and one has to be understanding. But, you know, if I would recommend to people, if you possibly can have your children younger,
then go for it.
But it's obviously, we all understand the practical problems, the financial problems, you know, the double mortgage have you.
Yeah.
So it's not easy for anybody.
No.
I'm not going into the feminist question.
No.
But from the biological perspective, obviously, the younger you are, not in terms of adolescence, I may say.
No.
But certainly in your 20s and late 20s, then if you can, go for it.
If you can, go for it. I think that's very good advice, actually. Let's focus on the men for a little bit.
Yes, why not?
Yes, I think it's a good idea. Should we be focusing on an input that a father can have throughout pregnancy?
Yes.
What can they do?
I mean, I think a lot of the work that we as researchers have done in the past has ignored the fathers far too much. I mean, certainly biologically, the older the father, the less the quality of the sperm, but it doesn't go off quite so soon as it may be done in women.
No.
But sperm quality does go off with age, and certainly if the father has an unhealthy lifestyle, particularly if they are obese, then sperm quality will be compromised. So if you've got a poorly functioning oocyte, the egg and the father's sperm, then obviously the chances of a healthy embryo and the pregnancy are lessened. So there are a lot of studies in father's sperm and why the damage may occur to the sperm and so on, and it goes up with age.
Yeah.
But the other thing is to support the family in terms
yes.
of the general lifestyle. So
yes.
it's extremely difficult if you're the mother and you are doing the cooking, maybe you're not, maybe the father is, but to have that family feel of a healthy lifestyle, and if one of the partnership doesn't want to take part in that, then it's extremely difficult to create the right sort of nutritional family environment. So we do need to be thinking about the family. We need to be thinking about the difficulties in buying a good, healthy food. You know, it can be very expensive. I'm very much involved in government. I work for Public Health England on nutrition. I'm on their committee for nutrition in pregnancy and childhood, and we appreciate all of those issues, and we as in government need to think about how we can help people to have a healthy diet which isn't too expensive.
Well, thank goodness we have people like you out there looking out for us, because that's exactly why we needed you on this episode, because it's never straightforward. There's the question of privilege, different socioeconomic groups, where you live, that there's so many factors, aren't there, that can impact the decisions we make. And I think going back to preconception as well, it's not just all on the women, because
no.
I hear this all the time.
Exactly.
The men are 50% responsible.
Yes, yes. And alcohol, certainly profound alcohol consumption by men can affect sperm quality as well.
Yeah.
And it's united, isn't it? United efforts, and one should think about the
yeah.
family rather than the individual.
Completely. One area that, and then I'll move on to the next question, that I've actually got some friends currently that are going to sperm donor banks because they're of their late 30s, they haven't really met the right partner. Mm. And they want to do it themselves, which is quite remarkable. But there are options out there, aren't there, for so many people that don't perhaps have a
yes.
man in their life these
yes.
days?
Yes. Yes, I know somebody who's done just that and has a lovely girl who I'm very fond of, and a very supportive community environment. I do think you have to think about where your support's going to come from, and where your income's going to
yep,
come from.
Common sense again.
All the pragmatic things. Mm. It's not rocket science, is it? One has to think about that. The responsibility that it involves is huge.
It is huge.
But having a supportive family, immediate supporting family or general family,
yeah.
all those things are so important.
Good
if one takes that decision.
100%. Now, I was doing some research and read that around 1 in 4 births now in the UK are by C-section, which I found quite fascinating. But obviously, as we've discussed before, perhaps obesity does contribute to this
does, yeah.
particular stat.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So what are the best ways, if you can give our listeners some tips on how to heal themselves? What should they be looking out for here? How does this happen?
Well, it's like any wound. You know, you have to care for the wound and be just sensible in terms of personal hygiene. Obesity is a problem here because the wound from a cesarean section, from any other wound, is more likely to become infected if you are obese because there's more tissue to heal. It takes longer to heal sometimes. So, and you know, to be alert to the signs of infection, redness and around the stitches and so on and afterwards, because that can become quite nasty. And, of course, to seek medical help if necessary. Yeah. But it's like anything else. It's your body is telling you if it's painful, you know, lie down, rest. But, you know, once you're up and going, get the exercise going and the muscle strength. So you have to repair the muscles as well as that is the skin.
Well, that's just it. And what you've just described does not sound remotely favourable or glamorous, whereas for some reason there seems to be this new popularity in people opting or paying to have C-sections. I don't know, obviously no judgment to any mum. They have the right to choose how they want to have their child. But is there a benefit, if possible? We know these things. I don't know if I'm going to end up having a C-section. Is there a benefit for a natural birth via a C-section?
There's a lot of benefit for a natural birth. These days we're very interested in the microbiome, all the bugs, and the bugs that the baby acquires are going through the vaginal canal and pick up the mother's bugs. And there is some evidence, and it's not absolutely, you know, set in stone at the moment, but there is some evidence that may influence long-term health of the child and infection in the child. So in terms of breastfeeding initiation, sometimes that can be difficult too when you've had a cesarean section because all the stimuli to the initial lactation are not there. So it takes a while sometimes to initiate to breastfeeding. But no, it's not a major issue. And of course, you can have a perfectly healthy child and perfectly healthy mother. So
of course,
and the next pregnancy can be a problem if you've had a cesarean section. And we are now promoting vaginal delivery after cesarean section when possible. So people who've had a cesarean section, you needn't think you've got to have another cesarean section. It can be perfectly safe to have a vaginal delivery after that. Talk to your obstetrician if you want to do that. My clinical colleagues will. Everybody's trying to get down the cesarean section rate because it is healthier on the whole to have a vaginal delivery.
Yeah.
But it's not the end of the world if you don't.
No, of course. And it's reassuring to hear that people have a choice second time around. You know, obviously every case is unique. You could have, I don't know, colostomy bag or Crohn's or some different condition, which means you have to have a different type of birth or monitoring. There's so many factors, aren't there, that can impact things. And I think the type of birth that people are opting for, I'm finding it fascinating. So I'm at the stage now where I'm sure in the next week or two I'll be asked, how do you want to give birth? Where do you want to give birth? Water births, home births, hospital deliveries? I mean, is there a preferable one?
Personal opinion, I think one should have a baby in hospital, but then that's me, and lots of my colleagues will. I mean, the evidence is not really there for that. That's just my personal opinion, because truthfully, as somebody said to me the other day, there's no normal labor until it's over. But if you've had several babies beforehand, you know, the risk is really, really low, and home deliveries are, by the basis of evidence, absolutely fine. But there is always that lingering doubt that you might have to have an emergency something. So I would go on the safety side, but there's no evidence for that. It's a personal opinion, everybody out there.
Oh, completely. Yes, you have to make your own decision, definitely. Yeah. I think we can be bombarded by some people saying you have to do this or you have to do that, or I did this, therefore you. The worst thing you can do is go by anecdotal advice. So I think all of our listeners should know by now that we're an evidence-based podcast. We don't have any judgment, but please
remember
your unique.
Which is why I'm saying that's a personal opinion.
Exactly. So I think just to also question the fertility rate one more time, because I think 1 in 7 couples now in the UK are really struggling. It's quite a high figure. Have you seen this rising personally in your practice, in your work?
Well, I don't practice in clinical medicine, but I work with several professors who are in IVF. I know what they're all doing. There's been an increased need, and the increased need is through age and through obesity on the whole, and through problems with fallopian tube obstruction, through chlamydia infection, and so on. So there's quite a lot of that. There is an increase, and the other thing I think one needs to point out is that to be aware of clinics who will tell you that. Largely private clinics will tell you what the success rate is. You need to look at the denominator in their statistics, because they will often take out older women or, you know, so you've got to look carefully, and it doesn't always work. So the success rate is better than it's ever been, but it's still, you know, quite low, really. So it can take several attempts, yeah.
And it's a very expensive thing. I think I heard, now you can correct me if I'm wrong here, that in each borough that you live in, or different counties,
there'll be a different number of cycles you get funded. Yeah.
Which is so interesting. Yeah. So the NHS can offer a certain amount of IVF or support, but it does depend where you live. So it's a postcode lottery.
I think that is still the case, yes.
Right.
And maybe a little out of date on that, but yeah.
That's certainly, yeah. I think in terms of knowing options out there, it's just so important to remember that equally, just as much as when you get pregnant, one thing that terrified me was that the first thing the doctor said to me when I went was, 1 in 4 ended miscarriage. That's the first thing that I heard, which was quite an alarming, alarming thing to hear when you go to the doctor. I mean, why is that?
1 in 4 IVF births?
Births.
So miscarriage, it's worth thinking about what we know about the causes of miscarriage. Mm-hmm. Certainly miscarriages go up, the risk of miscarriage goes up with age again. So that's another issue. The risk of miscarriage goes up with obesity, and it goes up with gestational diabetes and some other underlying conditions like type 1 diabetes and chronic hypertension and so on, people who've got renal problems. So there are a lot of conditions which are associated with miscarriage. Probably the commonest cause is chromosomal abnormalities. So this is not genes. It's not thought to be hereditary. I mean, there seems to be a small hereditary element to it, but it's not basically what it is. So it's when the cells in the dividing embryo don't divide properly, and then the chromosomes are abnormal, and you know, fortunately, probably that will often end in miscarriage. Otherwise, you know, then we do know that congenital malformations can lead to children with real problems. So the worst chromosomal abnormalities then that ends in miscarriage are perfectly normal.
It's almost like nature's
way. You know, this is not a survival fetus. Mm. There are some other conditions, clotting disorders, which are something called antiphospholipid syndrome, which is associated with recurrent miscarriage. If a mother has repeated miscarriages, she may have a test for that. And then if that's the case and they're found to have these antibodies, then low-dose aspirin and low molecular weight heparin can help maintain the pregnancy. So that's one good thing that they've been found out relatively recently. And then infections can lead to miscarriage.
Much.
So there's a lot of potential reasons, but there's no real preventative measure other than, as I say, low dose aspirin.
Equally, I mean, it's devastating when it can happen to someone, and it's something that's so natural, yet I still don't think there's enough talk in society about miscarriage. It's so common. 1 in 4 is a lot. And I remember I was scared in the first 12 weeks. You know.
I mean, a lot of miscarriages aren't even noticed by people.
Yeah.
So 1 in 4, I think, is the estimate for the ones which include the ones which are not noticed by people. So they don't even know you've been pregnant at all. So the later miscarriages are less frequent than 1 in 4.
Yeah.
But it is. I mean, it's always a social thing, isn't it? I think in some societies it's far more accepted than others. But here it's, you know, I'm going to have a baby or everything wonderful. And then,
planned
and then it is a terrible, terrible disappointment, isn't it?
Yeah, I think for anyone out there, there's a lot of support now if you have been through a miscarriage. I think even if you ask your GP, they can give you some wonderful resources because it is so common. And we were chatting at the beginning about some ongoing research you're currently involved in, which is literally from womb to childhood.
Yes, yeah.
Could you tell our listeners about this before we move on?
So this is, I mentioned this earlier, this is the idea that, you know, health begins actually not in pregnancy, but even before pregnancy, in preconception, when you're preparing your ovaries or your sperm for parenthood. So we know, you know, if you look at the oocytes, the eggs of a mother who is obese, you can look at them before she's become pregnant, and they will show signs of some signs, minor signs of abnormality, not abnormalities, poor function, you know, not really disease. So, yes, the suggestion is that health starts then, a healthy pregnancy, a healthy infancy. And if you get it all right, you will potentially avoid a lot of the problems of adult disease. And we're talking about diabetes, obesity, high blood pressure, perhaps. Obviously, the environment in which you are nurtured and live is hugely important. But
you mentioned pollution, yeah, and that's something I was so interested to hear.
Yeah, so... it is very worrying that the knowledge that we have on pollution and the accuracy with which we can measure it now has led to quite a lot of studies looking at the pollution when women are pregnant and infants. And we can't say it's causal, but there is quite a strong relationship between the level of pollution where someone lives or their habitual activities, walking along roads and so on, and smaller birth weight, and some idea that there may be an increase in premature birth. Mechanistically, we don't understand that, but for example, pollution can lead to, some people say, to small particles getting into the blood. Maybe they get into the placenta. We don't know that, but that's one theory. We don't understand exactly what's happening. And then the chemicals in pollution obviously are potentially damaging to blood oxygenation and the blood supply to the fetus. So the fetus would be seeing perhaps less oxygen or molecules which are potentially harmful in terms of blood flow and so on. So we don't really understand it yet, but those associations are increasingly reported. And I do think it's really concerning.
I agree. Just hearing you discuss that, actually, for me, it reminds me of an episode we've done before on pollution, and we do know it does have such a huge impact on health now. It's just an area that we're starting to document and research more. But as a mum-to-be, I'm constantly thinking, I mean, the bane of my life is getting the tube into work in the morning. It's unavoidable for so many of us. Anyone wafts a cigarette smoke my way or a car exhaust, I'm trying to hold my breath walking down the road. It really just seems unavoidable sometimes. It's so tricky.
It is really difficult. I mean, we've known about smoking for a long time and passive smoking. And it's an extension of that, isn't it? So smokers or even indeed passive smokers, their baby's size can be affected.
I mean, I have to say, and this is my opinion, but I mean, it's an educated opinion. I detest cigarette smoke. I feel... It made my morning sickness in the first 3 months
worse.
I could not walk down the street without noticing someone outside their office block just having a cigarette. And I mentioned this to a particular family member who was like, oh, but it's got so much better since my day. And I was like, has it really? I mean, I'm sure it has, but even
certainly
for me...
In the workplace. And transport it has, yes.
Of course, but it's still such a... When you're exposed to something you have no control over, it's
and
tricky.
That is the infuriating thing.
It's very infuriating.
Nothing to do with you.
No.
I mean, in terms of pollution, there are things... If you do walk along a busy main road, there's a lot of difference between the pollution at the curbside and pollution actually at the other side of the pavement.
Yes.
So walk on the inside. And if you have a baby, you know, who, again, it might affect the baby's lung development.
Of course.
You know, don't push your pram right out onto the edge of the curb. Keep it behind you or keep it beside you. You know, there's small things like that. If you did that habitually, then the exposure would probably be less. But again, I must say this is not necessarily causality. We must be careful.
Yeah.
There is association. And the causality would have to be proven in some other way with biological biomarkers of pollution or something showing direct
links. We need a lot more research.
There's a lot more research needed on it. And, you know, people can jump to conclusions about sort of flame retardants and so on. There's some suggestion, you know, but we must bear this in mind as being in the research arena as opposed to being hardcore evidence.
And the NHS are on it, I think, because at my midwife appointment, I had to, because I live in central London, I had a carbon monoxide test Thankfully, it was all fine. But they are actually starting to monitor that.
Yes. And carbon monoxide is, you know, the one of the molecules which can reduce the blood oxygen supply to the baby. And certainly that's probably what's happening partly in smoking. Mm. Also, the actual chemicals in cigarette smoke are can be damaging.
Yes. Well, I think that's been one of the most informative bulk of our episodes that we've had. Thank you. But it does move me on to some questions we've had from the audience.
Yes, so of course.
You won't have been privy to these, actually.
Okay.
And it's always very hard for us health professionals to give out any form of advice. So let's just see how we go with these. So Fiona has said, my partner and I are looking to have a baby. How much time do you need to give between coming off contraception and trying for a baby? I mean, you know.
Okay, well, it can happen immediately.
There you go, Fiona. It could be straight away.
Yeah, and other people, it will not be. So there's no hard and fast rule about that. No.
Yeah, we were having this discussion earlier. I was actually sharing with Lucilla that I thought it would take me a year at least to get pregnant, and then it happened straight away. Yeah. So I guess I'm one of the lucky ones.
Your fertility can be improved very quickly.
Yes. Jennifer has said, I've been a vegetarian for the last 10 years, but now that I'm pregnant, I'm worried that this diet won't be offering the required nutrients. What can I do? Am I right to think this?
I mean, the biggest potential complication about being vegan is lack of red meat. We're not saying you should eat a lot of red meat, but then that means iron.
Yeah.
And if you're vegan, you probably know about that anyhow, but have your hemoglobin checked. We don't routinely give iron supplements to all pregnant women because, you know, the majority of women don't need them. And if you do take them unnecessarily, it can cause problems. So you only really need to take iron if you are iron deficient. So have your hemoglobin checked.
Yeah.
Because anemia in pregnancy... it can obviously make you feel very tired.
Oh, yeah.
But also you have less reserve when it comes to delivery and the potential, you know, everybody loses some blood at delivery and then you might take
some
a bit
blood was very nicely worded there,
some
I'm
blood
sure.
at delivery. Not a huge amount always,
good.
But some blood.
Good.
But and you know, you clock very quickly usually, so it's not
great.
Too much. But if you are anemic, it can take you longer to recover from that and you might need transfusion and so on. So just, you know, all these checks, health checks before you become pregnant, really important. And to take the multivitamin.
Yes.
You know, there's most of the vitamins in that have some homeopathic dose, but the important ones are vitamin D and folate.
That's good. Very good to know. Now, Mia has... Oh, okay. So, Mia, I think this is a question we answered earlier, but I want to have a water birth, but my husband feels this is unsafe. Is it risky?
The evidence doesn't suggest that.
Good. There we go. Straightforward answer there, Mia. Go for your water birth if you enjoy it.
I mean, if you have complications in pregnancy, I don't think anybody would recommend that you had a water birth. But if you had perfectly normal pregnancy, then there is no evidence against.
There we go. Now, Matty has said, I'm a week overdue. What exactly can help induce the baby? Oh, I've heard all sorts of wives' tales here, Lisa. Should I have a curry? Should
Nothing.
I bounce? Nothing. There we go. No miracle.
No. Normally, women would be delivered 10 days after, 2 weeks after due dates. The thing to do, actually, if you are over dates, is to keep an eye on your fetal movements. You know when your baby's kicking. The risk of stillbirth goes up post dates, but not just a few days or a week afterwards. But I think, you know, one of the responsibilities the woman can do is to be aware of the baby's fetal movements. And if you are worried, then act on it. Don't sit around. But it's, you know, a week, a few days. It's very common, particularly in first pregnancies. Most people don't do anything until 10 days.
Yeah. There we go. And just on the subject of kicking, I know that can start in pregnancy as well at various points. Mine started at week 17, which is apparently is quite early. I've got some friends who didn't feel a thing till week 25.
You're going to have a football player.
I know. And I'm starting to really feel that now. But it's so interesting. So remember, you are unique as well. And then the last question, Lily has said, I've never suffered of constipation until I got pregnant.
Yeah, that is common, sadly. The reason for that is that the gut is made up of smooth muscle, which smooth muscle all relaxes in pregnancy, and it also you retain more water when you're pregnant, so your stools are probably a little more solid. So drink a lot and have fiber in the diet. Both will help. But it is, I'm afraid, a common problem.
That's my favourite F word, by the way, fibre. I feel it comes up on nearly every podcast at the moment, which is good. And another F, actually, moving on to the best bit, which is our fact or fiction round.
Okay.
So, Lucilla, are you ready? You have to answer.
Absolutely ready.
It's hard as a health professional, I'm telling you. It's very hard. Okay. For first-time mums, the average time in labour is 1 to 2 hours. There we go. Fact or fiction?
I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that, but I can pretty much guess that it's hugely variable from my experience. You cannot put a figure on that.
I wish that's going to be my experience. Yeah. 75% of women successfully have a vaginal birth after C-section.
That's correct.
You can't travel in your third trimester.
It depends how you define travel.
Yeah, that's true.
So you can, but going on aeroplanes after, I think it's 36 weeks, okay, you're not supposed to travel. I wouldn't recommend going anywhere at that stage for travel because it's very tiring and everything else. And you can certainly move around.
Yeah. You can definitely walk.
But airlines do have, I think it is 36 weeks.
No, oh, they do ask. They've been asking me when I went away. How many weeks are you?
Yeah.
Morning sickness only happens in the morning.
That's not true.
Don't we know it? You can't dye your hair while you're pregnant.
I have no idea. I know
this is fiction.
Absolute fiction. I've never heard anything about that at all, so I don't know where that one came from.
No. Raw fish is safe to eat when pregnant.
There is some problem about particularly shellfish, so in relation to infection. Yeah, so it's much better actually for everything to be cooked.
Most couples get pregnant within 6 months to a year.
That is probably true.
The baby blues, depressive mindset post-childbirth is normal.
It's normal in that it does happen. It's not normal for everybody. It is quite common. It is potentially quite serious. It doesn't necessarily happen to people who've had previous mental health problems. It can come completely out of the blue. All I can say about that is it does happen, which means that it's normal. But if it does happen to you, then get some help. Don't try and sort it out yourself, because there are some very, very good people out there who can help you and make life a lot better.
There are. And again, like the miscarriage subject, so I'm totally interrupting our fast fire round, but it's serious to talk about something that can be so upsetting and affects your mental health. So
it can be devastating.
Yeah.
I work with a fantastic team in the Institute of Psychiatry in London, and they have a big group there, the perinatal mental health group, and they're doing some brilliant work right across the country. And the government is now making sure that all big hospitals have clinics for women who've had perinatal mental health problems. So it's coming right up to the top of the NHS care alertness. Much more, I hope, will be now done for women who have mental health problems. It's not just postpartum. It's also in pregnancy, really quite common. But don't think you're out there alone. You're not.
Yeah.
But seek help. And there will be increasing numbers of people out there to help you if this government initiative is introduced, which it will be.
Oh, lovely to hear that. And the last question. There are more mothers giving birth in their 40s than teens.
Yeah, I think that is true now. Yeah.
Yeah. Very good fact or fiction round there. Thank you so, so much. That was brilliant. So that does nearly wrap up this episode. But with every single guest, we leave with a food for thought. So mine today would be that when it comes to pregnancy and childbirth, I think knowledge can be quite powerful.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, definitely.
Equip yourself with knowledge.
Yes, equip yourself with the knowledge and know that it's all too common just to focus on the negative symptoms that come with everything. Whereas actually, I mean, I've found it quite useful to focus on being in awe of the breathtaking changes.
Yes.
So whenever I feel an ache or a pain, I think, oh, my body is amazing. But
yes, it is amazing.
Yeah, what it goes
quite
through
amazing.
Just blows my mind. But we need to keep, as we said, a healthy diet and movement in if you can, however hard this may be. But just really think of the benefits that it can have for you and your baby, and alongside a supportive network with endless benefits there as well. Keep those close to you updated on how you feel and how your development is throughout pregnancy. Now, I would love you, Lissela, to leave our listeners, if that's okay, with a take-home message, something you feel would be invaluable to them, any resources.
Well, I think what I would say is, and touching on what we said earlier about the complexity and diversity of information which is available on the internet, I'm going to offer you a really reliable source.
Great.
I am the Tommy's Charity Professor for their London Centre.
Oh, they're amazing.
St Thomas's Hospital and King's College London. And we, as a team, my team, work with them a lot on getting evidence-based information on their website. So whatever you read on the Tommy's website, it comes from a good source. And actually, on there at the moment, there's a questionnaire about fitness for pregnancy for people who are considering it. So there's a sort of tick box, and you can go through and see if you tick those boxes, which are good for a healthy pregnancy. And we're working on some research on that too. So that's really interesting. But what you'll find is information about diabetes in pregnancy, information about miscarriage, information about obesity, healthy diet, if you're a young mother, for example, and they also have a helpline as well. Fantastic service for our pregnant ladies in the United Kingdom. So do take advantage, because it's good advice.
It's free, it's online.
It's online.
Evidence-based.
And it's written by people who know what they're talking about. So, it's reassuring. And also, one other thing I may add one more is that we've done some work on speaking up. And that's why if you are equipped with some knowledge and you think something is going wrong, then you should speak to your health professionals. I think there's still this thing, the health professionals will know best, but they won't know unless you tell them what you're feeling like. And if you are worried, it's usually perfectly all right, but you may just, help you, your baby, if you speak up and say, express your worries. Actually, Tommy's have got a really nice little video clip which is on YouTube about that, and it's been looked at by many thousands of people who found it helpful. So, go ahead, say what you're feeling. Nobody minds. They're all there to help and listen.
Yeah. What a lovely, positive and uplifting way to finish that informative episode. I honestly know how busy you are and how many incredible, wonderful things you're doing for us all. So thank you for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure. Very good to talk to you. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode, you'll absolutely love what's coming next week. So make sure you click subscribe to be the first to hear it. And please do leave a 5-star review. It really does help to get our podcast out there, to reach those higher highs in the charts and to help more people. For more information about my Retrition Clinic, books, healthy recipes, events, retreats, and so much more, please visit retrition.com and follow me at Retrition on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.